Welcome. Welcome to our ninth meeting of the year. We have three more. Our next speaker on March 20 will be Dr. Julie Gerberding, the former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, also in this room. And I know you're all going to be looking forward to that. If you haven't silenced your cell phones, please do so. We'd appreciate that very much. And now let me introduce to deliver our invocation the Reverend Kurt Anderson of the Naples Community Church.
Well, if you are familiar at all with the New Testament, you know that whenever Jesus' reputation began to spread, people brought to him those who were lame, blind, deaf, sick, the lepers, the needy, healthcare. We may look at that New Testament record and think of Jesus as a walking HMO, but the reality is what it reflects is that everyone is concerned about their health. And so it's important for us to zero in on this very topic this afternoon. Also, because of health, health is a critical element in establishing the need that we have to keep hope alive. Scottish divine Thomas Chalmers said there are three grand essentials to life: something to do, something to love, and something to hope for. The importance of this whole element, this whole topic, is that we have something to hope for. Let's bow together and have a word of prayer. And our gracious God, we know that you lavish so much upon us, not the least of which is our health. But you've also given us opportunities to help others, to carry those to places where help might be administered, those who are lame and blind and deaf, and those who are needy. As this is our collective responsibility, it is also our collective calling. And we ask that even as we celebrate and enjoy the fellowship and the food of these tables, that we might recognize those responsibilities as we go forth. We pray these things in the name of your incarnate love. Amen.
And now, as is our custom, Shelley Church will introduce some very special student guests.
Thanks, Alan. We have Seacrest Country School with us today, which we're very excited about. And I first want to acknowledge our past president, Dick Wilson, and his wife, Barbara, for hosting our students today. And we appreciate that very much. And keep in mind in the future, if anybody is interested in hosting the students for next year, please let me know about that. That would be great. Accompanying the students today, and I'm going to ask the students to go ahead and start making their way up, if you would. Accompanying the students today is John Hears, who is the chair of the History Department at Seacrest. John, I forgot where we sat you. There you are. Thank you. Really glad to bring him. We have five students with us from Seacrest Country Day School, and just so you know, the school actually started in 1983, but the high school just started in 2004. So 2008 was the first graduating class. There are only 175 students in the high school. There are a total of 400 students at the school total, but only 175 in the high school, and I believe there's only 12 in the senior class this year. So we don't have all seniors with us today, but I think you'll be very impressed to hear from these students. As I try to do at each luncheon, the yellow sheets in the center of your table, this has to do with student scholarships. Our scholarship committee is going to start interviewing students in the next couple weeks. It's a very important part of our club activities is sponsoring students with scholarships. So I'm going to let each of the students introduce themselves and tell them about themselves. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Chelsea DeRose, and I'm a junior at Seacrest. As far as my career objective, I think mostly I just want to be able to help people, but I also want to do what I love, and I think what I love is math. So, and also traveling. So something like statistics and international business I would really like to look into. I'd like to do this at a really solid school. So currently I'm looking at the University of Richmond because of their leadership program and Vassar College. I think one of the most fascinating things about my school is that we have a thing called seminars, and they're leadership seminars. And basically, a group of 8 or 9 of us get together, and we sit down with the teacher, and we talk about things like ethics and leadership, and you really just build really amazing community skills and leadership skills. And I think it's so great that we can have that at our school. So thank you.
My name is Kate Workman, and through my involvement in Odyssey of the Mind, I've discovered a passion for creative problem solving. This combined with my strengths in math and science, I hope to apply to fields such as engineering, psychology, architecture, and possibly communications. I also have a strong interest in nutrition and sports science. And this past summer, I attended a program at Furman University on health and exercise science, which I loved, in Greenville, South Carolina. Other colleges that I have an interest in are the University of Richmond and Haverford and possibly Furman. And one fact about the high school that I really love and have loved for 12 years is the teachers, and I really believe that they make the school what it is. Seacrest is where I realized where learning could actually be fun and engaging, and the teachers, their involvement doesn't stop just at the classroom. They constantly encourage us and support us in everything we do, and I love that. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Rachel Bowden, and I am a junior. I hope to graduate from college with a degree in social work, and for a large portion of my life, travel abroad, preferably to Africa, to work at an orphanage in Ethiopia. In college, I also plan on playing volleyball and running track and field, because I do high jump at a competitive level. My choices for college, I'm really excited about the process. I haven't quite narrowed it down as much as I would like to, but my top choices are Swarthmore, Haverford, Washington University, and Swanee. A cool thing about our school that I really admire is that every Friday morning, the entire high school assembles in the gym and sits in a circle for about 15 minutes in complete silence. And if, like, individuals have the opportunity to stand up and speak, sometimes sharing thoughts concerning anything from personal experiences to global issues. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Constantine Baumgartner. I have been attending Seacrest School for 14 years now, and I'm a junior there. After graduating next year, I would like to attend either Stanford University, Duke University, or Washington University of St. Louis, and I would like to major in biomedical engineering just because I have a very strong love for sciences and math, and I'm also good in both of them. And I would also like to minor in business and administration to start my own prosthetic company for disabled athletes and injured soldiers. And something that I truly enjoy about my school, besides that I've been there for so long, is that I really do know every kid in the high school. I know all my teachers on a first-name basis, and if I have any problems or any issues, I can turn to any of them, and they will all help me. And it's a great community.
Hello, I'm Katie Burns, and I'm a sophomore at Seacrest High School. My two passions are working with people and telling stories. And so my career objective is to become a drama therapist. I've learned drama therapy is the modern use of theater as and the dramatic process as a therapeutic intervention, using a story to solve a problem. It's used in a wide variety of settings, including hospitals, schools, prisons, and businesses. Some of my choices for a college include New York University, Yale, or Columbia. And I plan on majoring in psychology and minoring in theater. A distinguishing fact about my school is that it fosters independent thinking. Students are encouraged to sculpt their own opinions. At Seacrest, there is a sense of community, both in school and in the world around us. Teachers and students treat each other respectfully like partners. We have special class periods, as my fellow students were saying, dedicated solely to debating the important moral and ethical values that teach us to be valuable citizens of the world.
Enjoy your lunch. We'll be back in about 30 minutes. May I have your attention, please? We have a new member of the Forum Club who is here partly because, or mostly because, she was able to twist some arms and help persuade our speaker today to speak. And as you know, you jump the wait list when you get us a speaker. At any rate, our new member, Pat Franciosi, longtime friend of our speaker, will introduce him.
Thank you, Alan. Good afternoon, everyone. I am delighted to be a new member of the Forum Club and to have the opportunity to introduce today's speaker. Senator David Duerenberger was elected to replace Hubert Humphrey as senior U.S. Senator from Minnesota in 1978. He is the only Minnesota Republican in history to be elected to three terms in the Senate. He retired in 19... Thank you. He retired in 1995 after having served on several of the Senate's most important and prestigious committees. Senator Duerenberger is founder and current chair of the National Institute of Health Policy at the Opus College of Business of the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Dave is a recognized national leader and consultant on health policy and has authored many books and articles on the subject. Dave's passionate interest in providing all Americans with quality and accessible health care did not start the day he moved to Washington. We have been friends for almost 40 years. Back in the early days, in Minneapolis, when Penny and Dave were raising their four boys, we went to swim meets, shared family dinners, birthdays, and camping trips. Those camping days in the boundary waters of Minnesota, they were the best. Kay and David Ouellette, and Kay is here today, were part of our little troop, and they will attest to the fact that Dave's camping skills left much to be desired. While he may have had the strategic vision for where we needed to go, Penny was the one who always navigated the canoe. Dave, however, was best at our fireside chats. We were enthusiastic young people who thought we could solve the problems of the world. Invariably, a major topic would be health care. Even back then, Dave would say that one of the most significant societal problems we would face in the next 30 years would be how to pay for quality health care in light of the changing demographics of our society. Another fact I'd like to share with you about Dave is one that you won't find in any biographical sketch. It is what Dave Duerenberger knows best, and that is how to be a good friend. Whether he is working on Main Street or in the U.S. Senate, he is there when you need him. Over the years, when we have had a family concern and called Dave, his first words would be, How can I help? And help he did. It is that spirit of caring and helping that he brings to the forefront when discussing where America needs to go to create a truly affordable and workable healthcare system. Please join me in welcoming Senator David Durenberger.
Wow.
I don't want to follow that. My thanks to all of you for being here. My thanks to the Forum Club and to Al Horton, your president, for inviting me, especially to Pat Franciosi for not just the invitation, but that tremendous introduction. It is a particular pleasure to renew acquaintances with many of you, which I've been able to do in the last day or so, and not to have to end this little talk asking you for a contribution. I served in the United States Senate with four presidents, each of unique distinction, and I'll be going to begin by quoting former President Bill Clinton, who said recently of the challenges we face as a nation, and I'll quote him, "No one has ever bet against the United States of America in 230 years of its history and won." So I'm optimistic about this country. I'm optimistic about its people and its future. Like all of you, I acknowledge that we're going through a very difficult period of time, the most difficult I've personally experienced. And it's important for us to believe that this is a time that had to come. Like some of you, it's nice to speak in an audience about my age, on average. Like some of you, I was born in the depths of the 1930s depression, when I was all my parents could afford to have. I finished military service and law school about the time the entitlement culture in this country began to flourish. For nearly 50 years, we as a people have learned how much we can have without paying for it, and that's not just true in healthcare, but in education, housing, energy, and income security. When the end to all that came last fall, most of us, our children, and certainly the generation that elected President Obama, all agreed, this is a time that had to come. Actually, I think I first heard that in my election in 1978. Three Republicans, two senators and a governor, were elected to statewide office in a presumptively Democratic state. 2 years later, we elected Ronald Reagan president of the United States and a Republican majority in the United States Senate. To fight inflation that had reached 14%, Paul Volcker and the Fed took interest rates as high as 22%, bankrupted our friend Gene Holderness at Minnesota Homes. Unemployment reached 11% in Minnesota 2 years after Reagan was elected president and the day that I stood for re-election. Like most of my Republican colleagues from Democratic-leaning states, I was nearly defeated. We hung in there as a people. And 2 years later, Reagan was re-elected president, carrying all but two of the 50 states, one of them being mine. Mondale was running against him. It was just enough people and elected officials that believed that this was a time that had to come. The electorate was moving from left of center to the center. People who once believed it was government's responsibility to guarantee their entitlement to rights of all kinds were coming to believe in earned rights and personal responsibility. Government's fiscal responsibility and the generational consequences of entitlement programs were of increasing concern. So was the expectation that government ensure the accountability of its public leaders and its private and public institutions. Public opinion has been telling us for quite some time, our leaders have been failing us. We need no more evidence than the instability or the inability of the executives of our major financial institutions to define cause and effect and cure. From Greenspan to Bernanke to Paulson to Geithner, no one can assure us, or more importantly, our president, what course, what resource investment will build sufficient investor and consumer confidence to end this economic spiral. As retired Medtronic CEO Bill George put it in last week's Wall Street Journal, the real cause of the problems we're in is failed leadership. Our wounds can be solved only by new leaders, end quote. So, it's no accident that the newly elected president laces all his remarks with references to personal and institutional responsibility. Now that said, I believe this is a time that had to come, and I'm glad it came in my lifetime, so we still have the capacity as a nation to deal with it. This country is in the hands of new leadership, properly chastened, or so we hope. The primary elections for president in 2007-08 were a wonder to behold. Neither of the major party candidates for president in the November election was considered a year earlier to be the most likely candidate for president. Hillary Clinton was preordained to be president of the United States. On the Republican side, it appeared anybody but McCain. And John nearly dropped out in 2007. So on the evening of November 4th, 2008, every one of us watched two Americans deal with our decision. In Arizona, a famed Vietnamese prisoner and the man whom Ted Kennedy recently called the most effective person in the United States Senate, John McCain, delivered a concession speech which has few parallels in election history. Then a 500,000 people stretched as far as the eye could see watched in person as another senator, the son of a Kansas mother and a Kenyan father, accepted our decision in Chicago's Grant Park, turning another page in the history of the greatest democracy this world has ever seen. Barack Obama was not the youngest person ever elected president of the United States, but he was the first elected in modern times by the children and the grandchildren of those of us from the Greatest Depression. So I'm optimistic because the challenge of shaping the future has just passed to a new and excitingly involved generation of Americans. It is to them that our political leaders must look to fulfill the promise of this election. And the new world, the new economy that must come from everything that we've gone through, this will be the challenge that we can believe in. So that leads me to the subject you asked me to address today from the perspective of now 35 years involved in health and healthcare reform at almost every level. What's wrong with the U.S. healthcare system that leads to demands for its reform? And how will we get it right? Reminds me of the story Howell Heflin, the senator from Alabama, told after the Clinton failure. He said Claude Pepper, who was the congressman from Florida, died, went to heaven, and asked St. Peter if he could see God. And he said, sure. So he goes to see God, and he says, we've been trying to do health reform in the United States forever. Will we ever be successful? And God looks up at him and says, I got some good news and some bad news. He said, the good news is yes, and the bad news is not in my lifetime. So, let me start with the price we pay for a dysfunctional market in healthcare, and that's probably where I'm going to end up. In all of our efforts to reform healthcare in this country, and again yesterday at the White House, we have always agreed that the best way to contain costs is to improve the quality and the value that Americans receive for the money they spend. Republicans and Democrats agree on this. They just disagree on the ways and means to do it, which makes it difficult. It is difficult because the United States does not have a national health system like other developed nations, where improving quality simply means electing a party that will spend more. And cost containment means electing a party that will spend less. Rather, we have many health systems that differ dramatically in their effectiveness. It is difficult because for the last 40 years, clinical research in America has demonstrated remarkable variation in the way medicine is practiced across this country and in its value to patients and to society. We have amassed incontrovertible evidence suggesting that much of the care delivered in the country has no positive impact on our health. In some parts of the country and in some parts of this state, the care is harmful to patients, and all of it is unnecessarily costly to us and to the society in which we live. Experts of every political stripe will tell you this. We are paying $2.5 trillion this year for about $1.5 trillion worth of healthcare goods and services. Besides poor quality and unnecessary mortality, the result is a growing number of uninsured and underinsured, harmful delays in dealing with illness, and greatly increased costs of emergency services, hospitalization, and particularly the last 24 months of life for the terminally ill. The excess of costs over value received could be could more than cover the cost of appropriate subsidization of private and public universal access or coverage. So you can see when the president is challenging us to get the coverage by reducing costs, this is what he's talking about. Plus, we could return all the investment costs in a value-based system, plus encourage employer continuity of work of coverage for medical and health management services. Plus, we could have money left over to assure all Americans that Medicare and other valued access programs will never bankrupt us or cause us to have to raise taxes. And I'll address that at the end. If what I've just said is true, then why can't our health professionals and our policy leaders act on it? Obviously, we can't, because we just, you know, it's one of us against the system, no matter where we, how good a system like Alan's and yours in this community that you enter into. So what's the problem? It's not because the research is faulty. It's because too many in the healthcare industry that we've created are in denial that they are part of the problem. So it's difficult for them, the medical experts on whom we rely to diagnose our ills, to help us understand their own. And why change we can believe in is essential to our health and to our society. I told Alan and several other people as we came in here that everything I've learned from physicians who are not getting rewarded inside a system for doing what I'm talking about doing. So this is a broad brush across this country, but there are leaders in your midst who I'm going to talk about, not in name, in 1 second. Many in professional and political leadership allege that we have the best healthcare system in the world, that medical markets would work if only we had more skin in the purchasing game, and that any effort by elected officials to change the system is socialized medicine. As successful business people, markets depend on maximizing prices and sales volume. Producers compete over comparative value to consumers. We've not been able to get there in healthcare for three reasons. One, most people are not spending their own money, and if forced to today, couldn't afford it. Second, none of us have the information we need to make either a choice of health insurance that works for us or the doctor that we want to work for us, assuming we even have a choice of a doctor. And most importantly, the doctor-patient relationship, we have too long delegated decision-making authority to the doctor and have never learned to question how well he uses that power. In other developed countries, prices for medical goods and services are half of what they are in the United States. Not because medical markets work in those countries, they've never even been tried. Because in some form or another, national governments set prices and producer subsidies, and this determines the volume and the price. And you can ask any American drug or device or diagnostic company that does business overseas. We in America front-end the investment costs in medical research to cure diseases, improve drug, device, and diagnostic technology, and every other nation gets the benefit of our research. Then we talk about supply and demand. In this country, national reform efforts have focused on reducing the supply of medical services. That's logical because if you're in Congress or some other place like that, you're not a doctor, you don't really understand the problem well enough, so you work on the supply. There seems to be too much of this, too much of that, and it's all too expensive, so you work on supply. The reforms have taken form of supply regulation, certificate of need, such as Florida, I think, still has, before new hospital beds or multi-million-dollar technology is acquired. Or price regulation, as in the Medicare program's efforts to pay hospitals by diagnostic-related groups, or DRGs. Or insurance company-managed care, which is supposed to make the doctor and the hospital change behavior in exchange for large blocks of healthcare business. None of this has worked. So, we went to the demand side. Republican-sponsored efforts in the last few years at consumer-directed healthcare, shifting costs to the consumers who are in need of healthcare, shifting from large group and employer-paid coverage to individual insurance with high deductibles, often financed with a tax-free health savings account. But without the information patients need to make good choices of providers, and without the incentives that the providers need to help patients make fully informed healthcare judgments, that is a demand reform that is ahead of its time. Last April, I gathered 40 of the veterans of the last Washington, D.C. effort at health reform under the Clintons for a weekend in Minnesota. They were Democrats and Republicans. They were White House architects, congressional leaders, Senate and House members, conservatives, liberals, members, staff, and all are still engaged in some way in healthcare. We started with the dean of all the Washington pundits, David Broder of the Washington Post, who wrote a book called The System off of our experiences. We talked with experts about the system today, about the politics of the and how the politics and the public have changed in 15 years, what plans are on the table, and by Sunday noon of that weekend, we had agreed on many things and disagreed on almost nothing. We agreed that what each of us experienced then and what we have believed since then was totally dependent on where we stood or sat, and none of us really understood all the forces that were at work until that April, 15 years later. We agreed that each one of us was willing to go anywhere, do anything at any time to make sure that the next president in Congress that takes on the task gets it right from the start. To us, that meant the process, the environment, if you will, is much more important than the plan. That taking the politics out of health reform before you ever start is critical. That industry stakeholders may be in the room discussing, as they were yesterday, what they can contribute to change, but they can't be in the middle of the room where and when decisions are being made. And most importantly, we all agreed that the key to success is the American people. Not the people they send to Washington, and not their lobbyists. The key to effective reform is to change the policy at the top so that system reform will happen from the bottom up, from Naples up or Fort Myers up. You need to change the policy at the top. And only the president, the key to this is presidential leadership, and only the president can give us the vision of what it would be like to live in an American health system. One that plays to our strengths rather than to our weaknesses. No president that I've worked with or observed has had either the understanding or the willingness to do this until today. Barack Obama has no choice. He also has the gifts that it takes to do this. He's able, is he willing? We'll find out. To give us the vision that enables us to see the future where it already exists in communities in America. Like Tom Friedman in his campaign for a flat world, President Obama has the ability to show us communities in this country where you can actually see the future of an American health system. Because health professionals have already seized the opportunity to begin to define it. We don't need a congressional stimulus plan to move us. We simply need to see where it is we need to go. And I can tell you from experience that that vision will not come from the new Secretary of HHS, nor from the White House czarina, nor from the powerful finance or ways and means committees of the Congress. It must come from us, the American people. An American health system. It starts with the genius of America. The genius of this country is communities like those I know in Minnesota, which provide lots of leadership in many ways. The genius of our country is found in the fact that we do not, as a country, have a common gene pool. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. We are, think about this, because it was a light flashed on for me. We're by far the largest representative democracy in the world that doesn't have a common gene pool. We are and we continue to be a nation of immigrants. From every nation, culture, and religion in the world, and in this diverse American culture, have always been the seeds of inspiration, of ideas, of innovation, and of the entrepreneur's willingness to bear risk. A tradition of this immigrant nation and the representative democracy is not our government, although it's a significant element. It's our commitment to community, to leadership at the local level. And as Minnesotan, born and bred, I recognize the debt that I owe to those who can change the world without having a title or the authority to do so. Only the power of an idea. Earlier, I referred to 40 years of health services research. That body of research demonstrates that the future of the American health system does not just lie ahead. It's here today. In community-based healthcare systems in many parts of America, you can come with me, and better yet, you can hopefully go with the President of the United States. To states like Hawaii and North Dakota. To communities like Richmond County, Washington, Seattle and Richmond. Or King County, Washington, which is Richmond and Seattle. Or Multnomah County, Oregon, which is Portland. I could take you to Ogden, Utah, Grand Junction, Colorado, Billings, Montana, Appleton, La Crosse, and Marshfield, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, to cities in Vermont and New Hampshire, and to many places in California served by a nonprofit called Kaiser Permanente. And I guarantee you, you'll see the future. The genius of an American health system will most likely be seen in physician-led organizations. I didn't put that in there because Alan was a doctor. I didn't even know that until today. He delivered Al's child, right? That Alan, right? Often in competition with each other, with a tradition of putting patient care quality and improvement first. Right after improving the health of everyone in the communities that they serve. They are saving money in amounts that would literally blow your mind when compared to other physician hospital systems in this country. The Medicare Advantage program pays hospitals in Miami pays Medicare Advantage plans to fund hospitals in Miami 248% more than they pay either the Mayo Clinic or the Gunderson Clinic in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Not because people are older or sicker in Miami, that's all factored out. Simply because of the overuse, the harmful overuse of medicine in Miami Hospital. That's our currency, so where's the incentive, you know, in La Crosse to do better? They do it because they're physician-led organizations that are driven by a common purpose, but they're all located at a community level somewhere in this country. The genius of our America is in communities like those I know in Minnesota, which provide national leadership in addiction and behavioral health treatment, in the deinstitutionalization of the developmentally disabled, in independent living movement in persons with disabilities like Courage Center, in the treatment of mentally ill like Pat has dedicated her life to, the multi-specialty group mental or medical clinic movement, the HMO, the retail clinics, the medical device industry, the health home, and so much more. All grows up in places and communities. The genius of America, therefore, is our ability to respond to a demand for low-cost, high-value goods and services. If you look at your iPod or your BlackBerry, I ask you, where do you find that kind of genius and that kind of value and that kind of price reduction any place in the medical world? So the challenge to our healthcare system is to create a demand for low-cost healthcare services. And we can do that by changing how we pay and how much we pay for high-cost, low-value medicine. We cannot change our health systems without changing our attitudes and our behavior. The genius of America's past informs us that attitude and behavior change requires a shared sense of purpose, a we can do better. Somebody has to articulate that, and others must show us the way. In healthcare, we'll know it's happening when surgeons stop looking down on family practitioners, and when medicine stops looking down on long-term care docs, and when docs stop looking down on what they have insisted on calling the ancillary and allied health professions. When a Johns Hopkins University surgeon who adopted the commercial airline pilot's checklist to the operating rooms in all Michigan hospitals ended up in 18 months saving 10,000 lives and $175 million, when he gets the same recognition in the healthcare marketplace that Dr. Jarvik and his cholesterol drug does, then we'll know things have changed. Or when Michael Pollan writes a book called Omnivore's Dilemma, which has changed the food purchasing and eating habits of millions of us, can actually, as a result, bring down the price of eating healthy food. The genius of America is that in times of crises, we reflect on how much we have to learn from people with whom we once could afford to differ, from Democrats, from liberals, who are committed to the values of access and coverage, or from Republicans like Ronald Reagan and other conservatives. The values of personal responsibility, you get what you pay for, living within your means. There's no such thing as a free lunch. We can now talk with each other about these things. These are not our differences. So I'm going to come to the end of this by telling you that my experience in the Congress, our experience with our Congress, has been best expressed by Yogi Berra when he says, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. That's basically what we've been doing. So in this election year, the president made a very specific goal. He says, I'm going to cut the cost of health care expressed in a premium for family health care by $2,500. It's currently $12,000 on the average. I'm going to cut it by $2,500. So most experts agree that we'll know we're on the road to health care reform that is powerful enough to reach the president's goal and beyond it when we do the following. First, this is not comprehensive, but I'm going to do it fast and then get your question. Every person, every family should have its own doctor. You can call it what you want, medical home, health home, whatever it is. Every one of us needs a doctor. By any developed standard you can measure, America already has more doctors than we need to meet that goal. That's especially true when you add nurses, allied and ancillary health professionals, as they call them. The problem is largely in income expectations, the lack of organized health systems in many communities, the false competition I talked about, the affordability of health insurance, and the medical education and licensure system in this country. As a result, we have shortages here and surpluses there. There are 10 times as many psychiatrists in Richmond County, New York, as there are in all of Mississippi. You know, that's just one example. We need to redefine, redesign, and reform primary health and health care, starting with health professionals' education. Family and community health includes everything from oral and dental health to behavioral, addictive, and mental health, and can best be delivered by professionals who are motivated, trained, and paid to help us stay healthy. We can save 50% of the cost of chronic illnesses, which account for 75% of our overall costs, if we encourage better family and community health by paying, you know, the health professionals to prevent, help us prevent, reverse, and delay chronic illnesses. If we reduce diabetes by 40% over the next 10 years, we would save the Medicare system from bankruptcy forever. If we were to cut diabetes by 50%, we could cut the Medicare payroll tax. That's how big these numbers are and how big these opportunities are that we're just, you know, one at a time trying to take advantage of, or one community at a time. Secondly, every person, every family should own a health insurance plan and a disability insurance plan. Health insurance should cover health care services. Disability insurance should cover supportive services for people with disabilities at any age. We call it today long-term care, and we put people in the Medicaid program, and we put them in nursing homes, and we kind of like forget about them. After we change income tax policy to relate the public subsidies for insurance premiums to the actual cost of basic benefits, then government programs like Medicare and Medicaid can become income-related subsidies for premiums. This requires us, however, to establish national rules by which insurance companies compete on the basis of the amount of our risk that they are willing to assume, not to avoid, which is what they do today. When we can prove that insurance markets actually work, then mandates for us to own insured protection could be put in place. It requires employer and individual markets in which each of us has easily comparable information or a multiple choice of plans. Third, engage every person and their families in health and healthcare decision making. The best way to reduce healthcare costs is to foster a health culture in all Americans and in health professionals. It focuses on food intake, nutrition, and physical activity at all ages. The doctor-patient relationship on which all of us have grown up and old presumed the doctor knows best, and lawyers would get them if they didn't. Nobody believes inside the profession believes that works anymore. Today we believe in shared decision-making. Ask any of you who've been through the PSA test and the decision-making relative to how you treat prostate cancer. Today we believe in shared decision-making, the importance of an informed doctor and an informed patient, and that patient preferences should determine many of the decisions that we make. The new legal liability standard already in place in the state of Washington is called informed patient choice, meaning your doctor is required to make available to you all diagnostic and treatment options known to science and the demonstrated ramifications for people like you. That you are required to live with the therapy you choose, absent negligence on his or her part. Fourth, implement financing policies in research and healthcare payment that reward clinical and process efficiency, hospital safety, and innovative information and medical technology policy. Markets should do this in healthcare. They don't, and they won't without changes in public policy. Public insurance programs like Medicare and Medicaid and private insurance plans must stop paying for things that don't work. We know what they are. We need the political consensus and the will to stop. The first step is already in the works. Stop paying hospitals for mistakes they make and for their repair. Next, stop them from paying for avoidable illnesses and deaths that they cause. Still, almost 90,000 deaths every year. Then stop paying them for accidents and injuries they cause to their employees. And that list goes on. Clinical efficiency. The per capita number of days patients spend in hospitals and per capita number of physician services they receive while they're there is a major reason for variation in Medicare costs. That is, for the same procedure. It varies by at least 100% across this country from one hospital to another or from one part of the country to the other. And I could don't have it, but I could show you the Florida data. You can make these comparisons. Much of the excess can be attributed to the supply of beds or the number of specialty physicians. You can also get into specialty physician competition with hospitals and other things like that. Public investment in gathering the data to drive professional consensus is critical, as is the president's $1 billion federal investment in comparing the effectiveness of various procedures and technology. And finally, process efficiency. If Six Sigma, this is for those of you who've been through this, if Six Sigma is process perfection, you should know that American medicine is currently at about 1.5 sigma. Anesthesiology comes closest at 5 sigma. The reason the industry doesn't change is that we haven't paid them to do so. The Virginia Mason Clinic in Seattle re-engineered their entire radiology department and ended up saving 30% of the cost it had been billing payers before they began. Unfortunately, the clinic lost so much money, they had to close down the department. Why? Because they were not rewarded with a lot more diagnostic business at their lower utilization and prices by patients and payers who for some reason preferred paying the higher costs elsewhere. And you can, there are examples of this, and Alan is probably well aware of them, all over this country. And finally, policy efficiency. Eliminate all the cross-subsidies that hospitals care. I can't tell you what goes on in this hospital or not, but whether it's the uninsured or it's uncompensated care or dish payments or research or all of this sort of stuff that we are asking our hospitals to fund now that are simply transfer payments from underpaid Medicaid, for example, and that's the policy change that will enable him to compete with the closest hospital or with some alternative to a hospital. And finally, let me just say, I got to quit. On these policy goals, there's little disagreement, believe it or not. But getting from here to there is what is challenging. Only a belief in an American health system, the kind that I've tried to describe to you today, that relies on the ingenuity, the beliefs, the desires, and the willingness to change of the American people will get us there. We need to trust those in political and professional leadership to lead us. First to consensus goals, then to those who are already halfway there, and finally to the policy changes we need. Thank you very much.
Senator, thank you. Thank you very much. We are so glad to have you, and we want you to remember us fondly, even though you haven't had a chance to enjoy the area as much as you probably would have liked. We have two books, one on Marco Island and one on Naples, which you can read on the plane
thank
on the
you.
Way back to colder Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
And now, Pat will tell you
thanks.
What
thanks,
our audience would like to know.
Great.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Dave. Speech was well received. There are a lot of questions. I'm actually going to start with the questions from the students, and They're personal questions, so a little bit off the topic, but I'll be real interested in what you have to say. Why, after a career in politics, did you move on to healthcare? And are you happy and content with your decision? A student from Seacrest.
Thank you very much for the question. Let me just say that this is a passion. Like all the doctors in this room, all the people in the hospital, you know, anybody who's in this business has a passion. There's something about this profession, there's something about healthcare, because it is a healing, it is a preserving, it is it's an enhancement of who we physically, mentally, spiritually, if you will, are as people. It's very motivating. And so the whole idea of, whoever asked this question, the whole idea of listening to physicians and nurses and people like that in the system say it could be a whole heck of a lot better than it is, has fueled my passion to get it right. And you know, timing is everything in terms of when it gets done. And we are now in this very unique period of time when if we keep an open mind to the leadership of this country, you know, there's going to be a role for everybody in this change.
And now another, Dave. Equally as challenging. What would you say is the most important quality of a strong leader?
I think that's a relatively easy one, but the most important quality of a strong leader is what I've just addressed, which is a strong belief system. And it doesn't make a difference whether you're in the health professions or you're in the political professions or wherever you are. You have to have this motivation, if you will, which is grounded in a belief system. Someone asked me, you know, why did you leave the Senate? And I said, because I've always thought of elected office as a part-time vocation, not a full-time vocation. So I went in when I was 44, and I left when I was 60. And but I understood before I got there, when I was 44, what it is that government was supposed to be all about. I had basically a conservative Republican philosophy of what the role of government should be. That was my guiding force. The second one that's related to that, obviously, is character. And as Al Simpson, who's been here before, has famously said, if you don't know who you are when you get to Washington, D.C., you'll never find out there. And those of you who read my periodic commentary know I have a little thing called frogs in the boiling water. And this is true of corporate leaders, this is true of kings, this is true of political leaders. If you go into the water, you know, when it's nice and warm and comfortable and stuff like that, you'll never notice that you're boiling to death when the water starts, you know, when they're getting hotter and hotter and hotter. That's the problem. That's been the problem in the financial industry, clearly. That's the problem in politics. It's probably a shared problem in other professions.
Well, and in tandem with that, and on the personal note, what type of leadership development should a person be following in high school, and who did you look up to when you were our age, our students?
Yeah. Obviously, I looked up to my parents. I mean, I can still tell you, I met a guy who played football for my dad, who's a great obstetrician from Minnesota, and he's got to be in his 90s by now, but I met him at breakfast this morning. And so I looked up to my father, I looked up to my mother, and I learned a whole lot. And that's the first lesson there, is parenting. That's our responsibility, not yours. That's our responsibility. And my generation probably did it less well than your parents' generation is doing it. And you're going to do it a lot better, even though you didn't talk about that as you were talking about what you're going to do here. Teachers, how incredibly important. My teachers were all German nuns. They're a little monastery in North Dakota. And after I was halfway through my career in the Senate, I went up there and I visited, all my teachers were still alive. And they're like in their 80s and their 90s. And one of them was awarded Catholic Teacher of the Year Award for teaching computer science when she was 80. You know, if that were the head or the leader of every classroom in America, you know, that those kinds of people who can tell you everything about every student they have because they actually care about them and they care about the progress they make, that'd make a whale of a difference.
And now we're going back a little bit to more focus on healthcare. Wouldn't it be cheaper and better if insurance companies were not part of a national health care program?
Excellent question. Really very, very good question. I don't think we're going to know the answer to that until we give the insurance industry a chance. And just to quickly explain what I mean is the insurance industry, like doctors and nurses and other professionals, have insisted on being the rules for what they do are set at a state level. So you'll have 50 different rules in 50 different parts of the country, and as doctors know, if you want to move from Washington, D.C. to Florida or vice versa, you've got to take some tests and a bunch of things like that. That's not the way markets work. I mean, suppose you were a big company and you wanted to sell your product in 50 states or all over the world. You know, you don't want to be regulated separately in every one of these jurisdictions. But that's the way insurance works today. And they aren't really regulated on the basis of how much risk they assume. They aren't regulated in any way that you can compare one insurance product with the other. Because all they get is reserve requirements. That's the consumer protections reserve requirement. But if we had national rules that defined a basic benefit, basic insurable health benefit, and next to that, you know, we add some risk-related requirements. Do you have to take everybody that applies? Can you kick people out after a year or two or something like that? I'm oversimplifying that. But they have never learned to play by rules. And so a whole lot of people in this business shouldn't be there. But there is something to having a company bear the risk that brings out the best, again, in a marketplace. Because an insurer collects a lot of information on a lot of people, and if you use that information to change behavior, to encourage physicians, to encourage hospitals, to encourage communities that are doing the right thing for the right reason, bringing down costs for your premium payers, that'll make a big difference. So, you know, I think it hasn't been tried and needs to be.
Another question. Is America in danger of becoming a European-style welfare state?
That's true. And so thank God we went through this crisis. And we're going through this crisis because we're going to live in a much smaller economy, and the threat of having to use sort of a European-style adjustment, you know, where the government takes over this, the government takes over that, whatever the case may be, if that presumes that we're going back to where we were before, you know, then you could probably assume, well, we need the government to start taking over the banks like they're, you know, talking about doing now. But if you assume, as I try to assume in this talk, that the best system in America, no matter where it is, housing or energy or education or healthcare, is an American system playing to the genius of Americans that we've already demonstrated in other fields, whether it's choice in education or choice in healthcare or whatever it may be. Markets for a lot of the things that we need will work if the rules are set appropriately and there's an enforcement of the way in which those rules are adhered to. And most of that enforcement comes in the genuineness of competition. In large part, it's public subsidies, and I did a lot of these on the Finance Committee, public subsidies for housing for low and moderate income that used created the inflation that drove up the price of housing. And it's done the same thing in everything else we've been doing, including healthcare. So we haven't been tested as a nation. I put in the first bill with Joe Lieberman on charter schools, outcomes-based education, things like that. In medical school, it's incredible what people are paying to go to medical school, and they shouldn't be paying those amounts of money. They don't have to. They don't need that much of education, as a matter of fact. Our mistake is we're funding academic medical centers. We're not funding students. If we had loan programs, revolving loan programs, people could go into the health professions, pay back the cost of their education as a tax on their earnings. I swear medical education would change dramatically in this country. That's what I mean by having some kind of a belief system. And this is a country in which those kinds of belief systems translated into whatever our challenges are going to be can be effective.
How does our government deal with the rate of litigation in medical circles?
The government deals with it very poorly. And so this is about 20 years since I've been involved in trying to do medical liability reform. And I've come to the conclusion, as I said in this little talk, that we need to change the doctor-patient relationship so that it's more equal, so that we don't get away with saying the doctor has the responsibility, you know, I don't have any, I just do whatever the doctor tells me to do. That's where this idea of shared decision-making and informed patient choice. Washington State is the first state to do that. That requires a change in how we pay for our services, because we're going to ask every physician in this country to fully inform us of every option we have, what is the best, you know, scientific information we have about each of these, and then we are asked to make a decision. Now, that's not going to happen in an ER or in a crisis situation, but in so many of these costly consequences of chronic illness and things like that, an informed physician taking the time to inform us can change the legal standard so that we become the people responsible, or at least it's co-responsibility.
Well, we have so many good questions, but we're down to our final two. Since national health care of any nation is rationed health care, why would intelligent people accept national health care?
Most intelligent people who tell me they would like to accept it, and I listened to a congressman yesterday on the White House conference talk about his constituents, have sort of given up. They haven't seen, and they don't live in communities where you can actually see an American system at work. They've given up on the current system, and so they say, well, I'm for a single payer. I'd rather have the government take over or something like that. And these are very intelligent people because they haven't had another experience to rely on. On the issue of rationing, until we test markets in healthcare, I mean really test them, not the kind of competition we have today, but value-based decision-making in which we jointly share with Alan and the physicians in this room and so forth in this decision-making process, we don't know how to go to the rationing issue. We have to deal with end of life. I mean, that's a mess. There's too many people, some of whom are in my religion and stuff like that, who say, you know, you know what they say, and I won't get into that issue, but that's important to address. But the critical part of this is, as a nation, we might go to rationing in some way. We might go to decision making, which says you can't do this if you haven't done that, sort of thing. But not as long as we're spending $2.5 trillion on $1.5 trillion worth of value. There's no reason to make people stand in line. There's no reason to have half our population take second-rate medicine, because there are too many other opportunities to bring the cost down, and there are too many professionals who have the capability to lead us to that kind of a future.
And our final question, how do you feel about Al Franken being your next senator?
Wow! Well, I'll just tell you one quick story. My wife and I and two granddaughters are sitting in a restaurant in St. Paul near our home on the Sunday. It's like 10 days before the election. And in comes Al Franken with a camera crew and all that sort of stuff, and they see us sitting there. And I said, "Hey, Al, how are you? Shut off the cameras." "Okay, fine." And he shakes my hand. He said, "I wish all Republicans were like you," and all that sort of thing. And I said, "Well, that's a great opening, because I want to tell you something. And that is that about 4 years ago, I heard you speak at a hospital, a fundraising event. You spoke about your mother and the care that she had at that particular hospital. And it was really moving to me." And I thought, "Oh, you know, this guy, for a Democrat, you know, this guy, you know, he's really got something." But I said, "Since your campaign started, your campaign's been on for 2 years. And I have not, I'm a former senator, you know, 3 terms. I cannot tell you, Al, what kind of a senator you're going to be. It's a problem we have with campaign financing. You know, all this money gets spent beating up on the other guy, and a guy like me can honestly say to you, and I've said this in Minnesota, I don't know, Al, what kind of a senator you're going to be, because there was nothing in 2 years of campaigning that gave me the same clue that I got in one speech at a hospital fundraiser. Isn't that amazing what's happening to this country?" Thank you.
Thank you all very much, Dave.
Maybe I can take all the questions.
Yeah. I would just like to say in closing, the first person to ask Dave was Penny Durenberger, and we need to thank her as well.
Yeah. We'll see you all in about 2 weeks right here.